Hello and thanks for tuning into the Selection Show. I'm Citywire Selector News Editor Ian Heath, and with me today I have Kathy Hepworth, Head of Emerging Markets Debt at PGIM Fixed Income. Thanks for joining us today, Kathy.
Glad to be here.
We live in a changing world driven by geopolitical rivalries and changing dynamics in the world economy. And emerging markets are perhaps at the forefront of this change. Kathy, I want to discuss a few of these kind of themes with you today. First of all, I understand you feel there's a rapid transformation going on in the world, which is driven by great power competition between the US and its rivals. Why is this rivalry driving so much change, and what impact do you think it will have?
What I think we need to understand is, where were we coming from? We were coming from what I would describe as the period of the Great Moderation and a unipolar moment, where it was much more obvious that the U.S. was operating in a world with alliances, and the U.S. had a lot more dominance than it does. I think if you look past to some of the shocks that we've had over the past few years, the COVID shock, as well as the different conflicts that we've encountered, that brought with it lots of complexity and uncertainty, and it brought with it lots of change. And that change is a function of, I think, loosening of some of the economic anchors which the world got accustomed to. Right? We were in a period of, when I say the Great Moderation,
sure,
where interest rates were low for a significantly long period of time. Mm-hmm. And there was more predictability. Now there's more complexity and more uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that world is going to be characterized by likely more frequent conflicts, by unprecedented political polarization. And we saw that happening really probably within the past 10 years, but it was just amplified as a result of these conflicts. Bumpy energy transition is likely going to characterize this period of the great power competition, because let's characterize it as both the West as well as China. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to be vying for the same sorts of commodities to help along with this energy transition. And then obviously there's supply chain de-risking, which is occurring. And it occurred as a result of the COVID shock, and it also occurred as a result of some of the other conflicts and the consequences of that. That changes the alliances that had been in place beforehand, because the economic advantages change as a result of that. And I think one other factor to remember is technological change is also occurring along with all of this. And there's implications for spending and the fiscal results in the haves and the have-nots, and public investment and what that means from a competitive landscape.
Okay, sure. A lot going on there. So tell me, what role do you think emerging markets in particular will have to play in this rewired world, if you like? And are there any areas in particular you think need to be watched?
So emerging markets are going to be essential for the great powers, if you will, the U.S. and the China. They are essential in order to the other alliances that these great powers are going to need, since it isn't a unipolar world anymore. And in particular, trade flows. If the world that we knew beforehand, particularly from the perspective of global trade, is going to change, perhaps China is going to be more integrated with emerging markets. The U.S., which had likely taken its eyes off of what was happening in the emerging market world over the past 20, 25 years, is going to trade more with a lot of the emerging market countries for lots of reasons. Some of that's just a function of demographics. Some of that's a function of the resources that a lot of emerging market countries, particularly those in Latin America and those in sub-Saharan Africa, have, that the U.S. is going to need for some of these transformations that are taking place. For example, energy transition.
Okay, sure. And which sort of commodities? Is this things like copper?
Anything that's needed. Copper, anything that's needed for EVs, you know, lithium, cobalt, any of the metals that are needed for the energy transition or for any of the other technological changes that are likely to occur.
Yeah. I mean, I do recall last time I spoke to you, you said you felt the West and perhaps the US in particular taken its eye off the ball in terms of its relationships with emerging markets. You know, has this changed since? Do you think they're kind of making more effort to sort of address that balance? Because I think it's quite well known that China's making a lot of inroads in this sort of area.
Yeah, it changed in a number of ways. First, I think it became much more apparent just how invested China was in, for example, parts of sub-Saharan Africa after COVID, when we saw a number of defaults in emerging market countries, and the debt restructuring process was impacted by the fact that now China was a larger bilateral creditor than had been perhaps in previous episodes of sovereign defaults. And that slowed down and complicated the restructuring process. Why does that matter for the U.S.? It matters because the U.S. has influence over the IMF. The U.S. cares about global growth. It cares about the resolution of these events and restructurings. And I think that the U.S. realizes that it has less influence in lots of parts of these worlds as a result of not having the financial ties that China has as a result of the Belt and Road initiatives, for example. The U.S. has invested less in areas of sub-Saharan Africa and areas of Latin America. And as a result of that, as political change evolves in these different regions, it's not a given that the orientation of the political leadership is necessarily going to be toward the West. There's more of a choice now in this period of great power competition. So I think the U.S. realizes that and wants to encourage closer ties. So the U.S. has a bigger influence over perhaps what happens and a bigger access to these countries, be it from a political perspective or from a resource perspective.
That's interesting what you're saying there. It just seems to be this confluence between the changing geopolitical situation, the rivalries, and this change in the economy we're seeing, the transition and the need for resources. Turning to more of a kind of investment perspective, where can investors find value in emerging markets this year? Where are the sort of places you might be looking?
So one of the great things about emerging market debt in particular is the different ways in which to invest. And by that, I mean there's different sectors. There's the credit sector, where you can invest in sovereign bonds, quasi-sovereigns, corporates, local bonds that are issued by the domestic governments, currencies. Right. So there's a lot, depending on the global context, the economic context, there are different ways to express a view. Where we are right now in the context of a world where there's likely to be a soft landing in DM, where China is at least exhibiting signs of growth anywhere between 4.5% and 5%. So China's not going to be in a recession. There's a soft landing in China. The euro area is recovering. That's not a bad world for asset classes like emerging markets. So which of these segments is probably the more attractive place to be investing? Right now, we think it's spreads. And why is that? Because for the other sectors, interest rates and FX, the strong dollar and the stance of the Fed being on hold makes it a little bit harder to express a view in local bonds and in FX. That doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities there, because there are, because EM central banks are still cutting rates, perhaps at a slower pace, but and the dollar is remains strong, and but there still are some emerging market currencies that are high carry, higher yielding, and again, the world is seeking carry, the world is seeking yield. Why we think the better opportunity is in spreads, even though spreads have tightened, is because you get a wider dispersion of opportunity in spreads.
Sure.
There are certain countries that are still trading at stressed and distressed levels. And we're moving closer to a resolution of some of those situations. So there's still good value. There's still potential for upside. Again, in a world where yields are attractive and it's steady state. You can get good returns and you can get carry of nine, you know, double digits. Let's call that double digits. And then you also have higher quality credit issuers, sovereigns, corporates, or quasi-sovereigns, triple Bs, double Bs, that have proven to be incredibly resilient over the past few years, even with the shocks that we've had, that have market access, that if tail events were to arise, they're not necessarily going to have a credit event as a result of that. And there's still attractive spreads and yields relative to what's available in DM. We're still operating in a world where, with all of the interest rate moves over the past few years, where there's an opportunity cost of not being invested.
Okay, that's interesting. And in which regions do you feel the opportunities are? Are there any places which are perhaps under the radar in terms of, you know, being attractive?
I think it's really a mix of different regions that fit the investment thesis of what I describe as the credit barbell.
Yeah.
So there are parts of Latin America, higher quality Latin America, such as Mexico, where there are some quasi-sovereigns and corporates that are trade at spreads of 100 or 200 basis points wide to the sovereign or to similarly rated U.S. or European corporates. We think that's attractive. Again, they don't have any refinancing needs. They're oftentimes global operators. So they benefit from this soft landing scenario. Mexico in particular benefits from reshoring, nearshoring, getting lots of FDI. So that's a way to play, if you will, to play that that part. There are other countries in Latin America that are stabilizing, that have probably deteriorated, say, over the past 10 years or so, a Colombia, a Panama, but that's reflected in prices now.
Yep.
So there are opportunities now, and you don't have to go out the curve in order to express that view. Also on the higher quality end are some Central and Eastern European countries, the Serbias of the world, the Romanias of the world, where even though their proximity to the Ukraine-Russia conflict might make you think that they're vulnerable, they've actually done a decent job of from a growth perspective. And some of those countries as well are benefiting from nearshoring, reshoring, and some Asian countries, Indonesia. Also, so I put those in the bucket of the higher quality, kind of more resilient part of the barbell. And then you have distressed opportunities in sub-Saharan Africa, in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Sri Lanka, in parts of Latin America, El Salvador, Ecuador, Argentina. So it's not any one region in particular. It's more thematic.
Okay, sure. Another theme we spoke about last time was disinflation. Do you feel this is very much now in progress, and what opportunities might it be presenting?
That varies by geography as well. So right now, when you say disinflation, we think about China. In parts of Asia, which is much more in a disinflationary process, in part because of growth dynamics and because of overcapacity. Inflation has clearly come down from the highs of, say, 22 in EM, and inflation is coming down, but not in the same way that it was last year.
Sure.
So as a result, some of the EM central banks have pulled back or slowed down some of their rate cutting. This is true in Brazil. They're still cutting, but not as much as the market had expected at the beginning of the year. Some of that's just also a function of the fact that inflation dynamics in their own countries ended up surprising to the upside. So still a disinflationary trend, but not on the same path that had originally been priced in. So it's still an important investment thesis when you're looking at investing in the local markets, but it's being priced in differently depending on the country, depending on fiscal policy, depending on the monetary policy stance.
So what is the relative attraction of emerging market debt in the portfolio compared with other forms of fixed income?
So I think you get the diversification of owning emerging markets compared to other DM asset classes. So that still works. And it's valuations. I think that lots of fixed income has rallied this year. And because EM can be segmented, and because there is such dispersion of opportunities that you can look at, for example, EM investment grade and compare it to U.S. investment grade, and you can see that there's still good value opportunities, relative value opportunities, and part of that's a function of the fact that the developed world fund flows have gotten inflows, significant inflows, and EM still really hasn't. Mm. And I think that that probably won't come to fruition until the Fed starts moving, until the Fed starts cutting. And for now, there's crossover interest in emerging markets, but there's still really good value spread dispersion between EM investment grade and then even in high yield, EM high yield versus other higher yielding fixed income asset classes. Arguably, the developed market fixed income segments are trading at the significantly tighter end of the ranges compared to the EM ranges. So I think it's that valuation argument makes sense. When you think about rates, rates in emerging markets, real yields are really high, and they're much higher than they are in the developed world. And I think once the EM central banks start cutting more aggressively, they have been cutting, we think they'll continue to cut. But when it becomes more apparent and those cuts get priced into the curves again, that's where the value is going to be in local bonds. And for EM currencies, again, once the Fed cuts, I think the dollar will have less dominance. It will still be relatively strong, but where there's value from a balance of payments perspective in EM currencies, they're high carry, but the balance of payments situation, because there's going to be these FDI flows coming into the emerging market world, that will help the expression of the value in EM FX. And all of this really translates from a real economy perspective of EM growth outpacing DM growth. So the real value in EM versus sort of the rest of fixed income is EM is going to grow better over the next 2, 3, 4 years relative to DM. And that's where you'll be able to realize that value.